Célia Joseph Queen Sna to Natin Tlas, Quot Homish Nanemos, O Homeo, Alawin, Iaxthuin, Isqualawin, Iotin Sequatel, Iahichka Musqueam, OCM. Hello, my name is Célia Joseph. I'm from Squamish and Nanaimo Nations on my dad's side, and I am British and Jewish on my mom's. You are listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM. Welcome to Unceded Airwaves. This is UBC's first ever Indigenous radio show, and it is being created weekly by the Indigenous Radio Collective, which is a combination of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people here on campus and beyond who are interested in radio and Indigenous issues. I want to start by acknowledging and thanking the Musqueam people for hosting us as we are on their unceded traditional and ancestral territories. So on this episode, our hot topic is the theme of Indigenous radio. This is only our second episode, and we wanted to start off the show with giving ourselves and our viewers context about the importance of radio in Indigenous communities. And then the other part of it is for our listeners to get some history and context around Indigenous radio, why it's been important and why it's something to keep investing in, why it's something to keep growing and utilizing as people, as communities. And so to start and really contextualize this conversation, we wanted to interview Gunarji O'Sullivan. Gunarji has been very dedicated to the Indigenous community in Vancouver and the radio community for a long time. She has been actively involved at various different radio stations in the country, bringing Indigenous voices to media in Vancouver and beyond. So she's been very active in the community, and we thought that she would be the perfect person to interview and ask about her experience in radio, what has drawn her to radio, and why it's an important medium for Indigenous people.
Alrighty, my name is Gunarji O'Sullivan. I am a Tsawitsi's member of Turner Island, and I'm also a broadcaster from Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO.
So thank you so much for letting us interview you today and again interacting with CITR. And so Eleanor and I are here to get a little bit of background about the work that you do in the community, but we wanted to start at the beginning and we wanted to ask you first, what drew you to radio and how did you get started?
I began in radio in 1985. My name is Gunarji O'Sullivan. I'm a broadcaster at Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO, www.coopradio.org. I do a number of programs at Co-op Radio on Monday between 1 o'clock and 2:30. I am the host and producer of When Spirit Whispers. On Tuesdays, I do a show called Snow Wilds, which airs every Tuesday between 1 o'clock and 2. Again, I'm the producer and host of that show. Late Night with Savages, Wednesday nights between 11 and 12, I co-host with Gary Over. And Thursdays between 5 o'clock and 6, I've had the pleasure of working with Ross Bone, Spencer Lindsay, as well as Gary Over between 5 o'clock and 6.
Great, thank you so much. So what drew you to radio and how did you get started in this field?
In 1986, I was introduced to my brother Raymond Williams, who was currently working on a show called When Spirit Whispers, which aired every Wednesday night between 11 and 12 o'clock. He was the one that introduced me to radio.
Okay, and what was his involvement in radio and what attracted you to it?
Well, he was at the time the producer and the host of When Spirit Whispers, and he had heard some of my poetry, realized that I was interested in communications, and he encouraged me to become a part of the radio show. And at that time, I was a little bit shy, not only of being First Nations, but also of my own voice. And so I backed away. I decided, no, I'm too scared. I don't know. I was this and that. And then I met another woman who was working with him at the time, and her name was Carrie Charney. And she kind of pulled me back in to the station and just kind of threw me to the wolves. And next thing you know, I started getting the hang of it. I would do public service announcements, introduce songs. And then I eventually started covering stories. In fact, one of the first stories I covered was with the Spokane Valley blockade that was happening. And to this day, it's still going on. It's blockade which involves the Sinaiks people.
Wow. So it seems as you were getting your footing in radio, you were also getting your own grounding in your identity as an Indigenous woman.
Exactly. You know, radio has been a great tool in educating me and helping me to communicate issues with the greater community.
And so what has kept you going in radio all this time? It seems like you have a really long history in it. And what has kept you interested and enthused about it?
Well, I would have to say the community itself, the issues. I am a person who learns from listening. I come from an oral background, and I am most comfortable listening, and I have been able to find my voice. And the longer I've stuck to community and campus radio, the more I've come to know, the more I feel secure in my own skin and feel confident of being a First Nations woman. And then throughout that, I've met other people who work in radio but don't always identify them as First Nation, themselves as First Nations people. So I've come to understand that there is a need for our perspectives, and those perspectives actually help our community who has been displaced through residential school foster care and adoption in regaining their own identity. So that drives me. It helps me to realize that there is a need for our perspectives, why there is a need for us and our perspectives. And I know that it's important and that there is a lack of First Nations, again, the word perspective, in media, not just in mainstream, but even in community and at a campus radio level.
I really like that connection that you've drawn between urban Indigenous populations that have been displaced or have left their communities and radio. And I can see my own connection in being in radio in the first place. And I hadn't thought about it in that way until you brought that up. So I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
And so why do you think that radio specifically can be a unique tool for Indigenous people? Why do you think that Native people can be drawn to it, and how we can relate to the medium?
I think that radio can be used as a skill to develop our tools and for us to reconnect to our oral history. And I value radio on many levels. If we allow ourselves to have a voice and to reconnect with our culture through communications, it will only make us stronger as a people.
And so now I'd really like to dive into some more information about the current shows that you have right now. Could you tell us a little bit about what makes each show distinct from the other?
Okay. Well, When Spirit Whispers has been on the air for over 20 years now. It's one of the longest running programs at Co-op Radio. That show has developed from arts and communication to a show that specifically explores the idea of truth and reconciliation. It has focused on the residential school agreement, how that has worked and not worked for the people. It has shared stories from the community about residential school survival and intergenerational survival. And now we're moving towards the idea of healing. How can we rise above the atrocities and the findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and move forward? That's where we're at. We are also actually exploring the treaty negotiation process within the idea of reconciliation.
Okay. So this show, When Spirit Whispers, was what brought you to radio in the first place with your brother Raymond, right?
Right.
How does it feel to now be still engaging with the show? How has it changed while you have changed?
Well, it has changed because I've been able to, when you think about it, I didn't meet my brother until I was 20 years old. And he was adopted, and I was adopted. I was a residential school survivor and an intergenerational survivor. He was a intergenerational survivor. That in itself is kind of interesting and a form of reconciliation. We're able to meet each other, grow as a family, and reconcile with our experience. I've been able to understand my own mother, who is a survivor, through the teachings I have had as a radio producer and a broadcaster. I haven't been able to forgive her and understand why she was not able to take care of me. And as I said, I'm a survivor of residential school myself. I went to foster care, I went to residential schools, and then I was later adopted. So I see myself as somebody who has gone through the full nine yards. You know, I've been an orphan. My mother died when I was 6 years old. My dad died when I was 10. And as a result of that, I went to the residential school, and then I was adopted. So I've been through the 60 scoop, which is directly related to the residential schools. So I've been able to understand myself better as a First Nations person, as a survivor and an intergenerational survivor, which is a lot. That's a lot of healing to go through. And I think it's made me a better Indian or a First Nations person or an Indigenous person. It's definitely made me a better woman and a better lover, a better mother. You know what I mean? It has improved my life in so many ways that I can't even speak to.
Thank you for sharing. You're so generous with your stories and what you've been through.
Thank you. It's a great opportunity for me, Celia, to be recognized as an Indigenous broadcaster and a producer. And that is of great value to me. And that is another reason that keeps me motivated to continue on with the programming that I do. As you know, we are volunteers in community and campus radio. We don't get paid for what we do and what the services that we provide to the listeners and the community at large.
I think that it's so important and so crucial to know, going into radio, how much power this medium has. And I can't know unless I hear from people like you who've put their whole heart into this medium and into the community. There wouldn't be as deep or meaningful a place to start in Indigenous radio if it weren't for your contributions in this city.
You know, one of the other things that I've come to realize and appreciate is that, you know, my mother actually hung out in the downtown east side of Vancouver. She came from Alert Bay, ended up on the streets of Vancouver. She used to hang out at Pigeon Park, which is where Co-op Radio was located, way back in the day when I started my journey as a broadcaster. And so I find that fact really interesting. And one of the things I often think about is what would have happened if the doors of communication had been open to her when in the 60s and in the 70s. Would she still be alive today? Would she have been able to acquire the tools and skills and abilities to heal as a residential school survivor, as a Indigenous woman? Would it have saved her life and given her pride as an Indigenous woman, as it has given to me and has also been shared with other people in the community through the airwaves, you know? What a difference that would have made to our people in that time and era.
Well, I think that the information and the advice that you're giving us is how important it is to continue to invest in this medium so that our communities now and our future generations have the same outlet that's been so important to you and is starting to become very important to me.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM. You just heard Baby Blue by Morning Coo. Chandra is Blackfoot, Siksika Nation. My name is Thalia Joseph. On this episode of Unceded Airwaves, we are discussing radio in Indigenous communities and its importance. Tune in as we are interviewing radio and community organizer enthusiast Gunarji O'Sullivan. And so what I'm interested in is a little bit more about the idea that you brought up around healing. You've talked about radio in relationship to the own healing that you've done personally, and then you talked about it in the show, how you talk about healing in the TRC. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what that looks like to you?
Okay. Well, on that particular show, I mean, we're trying to provide information about the healing process. There are many ways that we can heal. We can heal within our own families, their communities, and we can move forward and rise above the atrocities. We can sing, we can dance, we can paint, we can carve, we can actually go and seek counseling, we can have circles and speak with other peoples in the community, and we can rebuild our family structures, okay? But the other thing that needs to be done is we need to rebuild language and culture, and we've recognized that throughout the last 5 or 6 years that language and culture needs to be revitalized. So I have another program on Tuesdays between 1 o'clock and 2, and what that show attempts to do is revitalize language within the urban city. As you know, Vancouver is a melting pot. So on Snow Isles, we have had a number of different hosts join us throughout the years on that program. It was founded by Ian Campbell, who is from a hereditary chief from the Squamish Nation. And so we have had him on the program. We've had people like Larry Grant, who is the Musqueam. We've had Haida from Haidaberg, Alaska. His name is Woody Morrison, who shares language and concepts on the air. We've had Laura Leiwilek, who is Halkamilan from the Stalo Nation. She teaches the language on the air. We share stories about current affairs and the news, and Laura Leiwilek puts it in the context of the Halkamilan language. We've had Orion Askew, who's from the Squamish Nation, and she has also taught the language, and we've also shared Cree language with a young lady by the name of Julia. And so that show attempts to provide healing through language and culture. And then on the show that we do on Late Night with Savages, we want to tap into the humorous aspects of the work and skills and abilities that we have. So we talk to comedians, we cover stories that are kind of funny about politics and news and First Nations artists who are actors and producers and so on and so forth. And then on Thursdays, I do a show between 5 o'clock and 6, which touches on current affairs. Lately, we've been covering the election, and we've been able to highlight First Nations candidates who were in the running, and now we're going to move on and cover those candidates who are now MPs. So I think on its own, providing this service is healing in itself, because we are making ourselves known. We are showing a presence in media and in communication that allows us and the people as listeners to feel good about who they are. We're not telling stories about drunk Indians, and we're telling stories about sobriety. You know, we're talking about empowerment. We're talking about rights and responsibility. And that's huge. That is the difference in itself. When you consider that in my mom's age, there were no people who were of First Nations descent working in the media at a community and campus level or even in the mainstream. We had a few broadcasters back then. Even Bill Reed, who was an internationally renowned master carver, worked at CDC. There was Alanis Oblomsawin and a lady named Bernalda Wheeler, who was a First Nations broadcaster at the time, but we were few and far between. And I think having representatives working at it as broadcasters, hosts, and producers really, really makes a difference in the healing process and representing ourselves and showing that we are not just survivors, but we are thrivers.
So when you're talking about your show uniting people in Vancouver around language and uniting different nations around language, how else do you think radio can be used as a tool to be connecting Indigenous people throughout the province and even throughout the country?
I think that we can continue to build relationships and understanding. And as Perry Bellegarde keeps saying, that gap of understanding, not just between our people as Indigenous people and the larger community, but also between generations, right? So I am in my 50s. I do programming with people who are in their 20s, and that closes that gap of understanding between generations. I also do programming with people who are not Indigenous, you know, and I think that's something that is important. We can hear those relationships being built. That is really essential. And I think that also as community radio broadcasters, that we can add levels. Now, so in a camera and a web stream, now we can see it and we can hear it. And so tapping into new technology is really important. And again, building relationships. People who are techies are different to people who are broadcasters. You know, I don't know if you realize that or have recognized that, but you can talk to a person who's like a technical support, works as a technical support at stations, and they have a totally different vibe than a person who is a producer and a broadcaster. And you can hear the difference, too. And I just think talking to people at many different levels can really create a really neat unification. You know, if we talk to artists, they also come from a different place than somebody who is a communicator. We talk to a literary artist, they're more in their head than they are outspoken, right? They speak at a different pace. A singer will talk and speak about different issues than somebody who is a painter, right? Painters are more visual. Singers more, I don't know. I just hear a difference in everybody that I speak to. And so, yeah, I think that radio is a perfect tool for us communicate those differences and points of understanding.
And so another project that you have founded is the Red Jam Slam. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about that project and how you came up with it.
Okay. Again, like, you know, a lot of our people haven't been given equal opportunity to produce CD albums or to promote themselves. So I recognize this actually through doing radio shows. I would have people come on the air and perform live, and then they would leave with a recorded cassette or a DVD, you know. And this would help them to use that in their proposal packages to get funding so then they could make CDs. Then I realized that we were not as prominent in festivals, and that it would be an awesome tool if we had a society that we could actually use to create events, like the Red Jam Slam festivals that I hold. So I was holding festivals and events at various bars to begin with, and then I did this for since 1995, okay? I went out and held events, and they were well attended, and then I realized that we could get more exposure if I began to hold radio festivals. And so I started to reach out to various community stations like CITR, CJSF and Co-op Radio, CKUT, CKDU in Halifax, and all of these different places who were willing to air my events live. And this was an exciting concept to me. So that's what I've been doing. And we've held three Red Jam, Radio Red Jam Slams. and we do this on an annual basis, and we invite community and campus radio stations to tap into our live remotes. Our last live remote was provided by CITR, and we were able to include 7 different radio stations across Canada to broadcast the live events. And through that, we were able to give 40 different performers 7 times the exposure that they would have had if we had just had a live event with no radio live broadcast. And I think that that's an exciting concept, and the people really appreciate it, and it gives us a great opportunity. And so I guess that's what I mean by adding more and more levels to everything that we do. And that's essential in keeping us out in the forefront, and it helps us to give voice to the performers as well. And hopefully in the future we'll be able to do more live web streams to give us some visual on these artists. The Red Jams Farm was founded in 2010, even though I had been holding events under the name Red Jams Farm since 1995. And so the society just allows us to apply for funding and make this happen on a bigger scale. We collaborated with the National Community Radio Association in 2013, and we applied for a fund for a project called Resonating Reconciliation. This is exciting, Celia. Because of that funding, we were able to contract 40 radio stations across the country to hire 40 First Nations radio broadcasters and producers. Those people in turn went into the community, and they interviewed people from their community to talk about residential school survivors and intergenerational survivors. And you know what? We even had one of the radio stations in Winnipeg. They hired Robert Falcon Ouellette to produce a radio show. Now, look where we've gone since then. He is now an MP representing Winnipeg. You just never know what will come out of the work and what kind of relationships and connections you will make. And so that project allowed First Nations community to work with radio stations. So I would encourage the listeners to go and get involved with a community radio station in your region and provide them with, you know, proposal to do a radio programming on anything. It could be anything you want. It could be soundscapes. It could be electronical music. You know, it could be poetry. It could be anything you want it to be. It could be a show about going out on the streets and talking to people about what they know or don't know about Indigenous people in Canada. Keep building on those relationships and keep those doors of communication wide open so that there is no sort of misconceptions about Indigenous people. Make yourself known and your community known. You know, give us a voice. Give us a fighting chance to be a part of this community and build and just keep building and building and never give up. Radio can save your life. You know, it can make a difference in your lives and in the lives of the listener.
What are some topics that you want to hear more of and more themes that you want to be hearing on the radio?
Well, what I would like to hear more of is, especially here in BC, is the treaty negotiations and the land claims. I want to hear from the community what they think about it. And what I've found in my own journey of understanding about treaties and negotiations is that there are so many things that we are unclear about, and that isn't our fault. We need to hold our bands and council accountable. We need to ensure that they are being transparent about the negotiations. We need to stop biting our tongues, and we need to be open about how we feel, so that everybody knows that we're not the only ones that feel that way about this process, and that we have concerns and issues around these negotiations. And until we do that, everything will just be underground and behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. Unless we call for that information to be public.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM. You just heard Luella by Ghost Keeper. Ghost Keeper from Calgary, Alberta, and Shane Ghost Keeper is from the Métis Nation. My name is Celia Joseph. On this episode of Unceded Airwaves, we are discussing radio in Indigenous communities and its importance. Tune in as we are interviewing radio and community organizer enthusiast Gunarji O'Sullivan. What limitations have you come across in radio broadcasting?
Limitations? Well, lack of information to some of the processes that we as First Nations people are going through. I think the only limitations I have are sometimes the ones I put upon myself, right? I've grown as an individual, as a woman, as an Indigenous woman. I think that there could be more funding provided for First Nations or Indigenous broadcasters and producers, but there is a lack of funding, and that Canada Council is now providing multimedia grants and things like that, right? But, you know, like, it costs money and time to do anything. And when you think about how much time it takes to put a radio show together, it takes the amount of time that you're on the air. You know that for sure. So if I'm doing an hour program, then I have to keep myself accessible to the people. So sometimes your job is never really over. You're out there in the community. People will come up to you and say, you know, Gunarji, you should do this story on this, or can you call this person? And they want you to follow up on certain story ideas. So you're always having to be approachable and accessible to people, whether it be on Facebook or via phone, right? So there's prep time and before the show and then after the show. And then if I have to travel, say like when I was doing programming at CITR, it takes an hour to get there, an hour to get back. That's 2 hours. Then the hour to prep and an hour to wind down. That's a full day, you know? And so when you think about the amount of time that I am working on each show, that every day is consumed by the pre-production, the production, and the post-production, right? And so I also think that there needs to be jobs at stations for people who have been, like, long-time programmers to jobs like Aboriginal program coordinators. Because every time I bring a new person on to a program that I'm working on, I then have to train them. They have to shadow me. I have to train them how to do introductions, public service announcements, how to do interviews, and how to record. You know, it's a lot of work. And I just think that there needs to be more employment opportunities for First Nations people within the context of community and campus radio.
And what do you think some of the goals that you would like to see from campus and community radio stations are?
All right. I would like to see more stations step up to the responsibility of rebuilding language and culture in their prospective communities. One of the motions that was made a few years ago from the Native Caucus was that we, each station, be responsible for recording an opening song and welcome from each territory based on the language group that they are in. And I think that that would be a great start in the revitalization of language.
And what do you think the impact of hearing your own language on the airs is?
I think it's important because it reinstills our values, and it's unheard of, and it would make people smile inside and out to hear their language and to be represented and to hear acknowledgement from a station that they are in their territory. It's invaluable in so many ways. It's recognition, acknowledgement, and it would reinstill a lot of pride in people. You know, we have a high rate of suicide in our communities because many people are ashamed of being First Nations. It would reinstill a lot of pride, and I think that is valuable in its own. And it would allow people on all levels to learn how to say hello and how to do greetings in a language. That's a positive thing. And, you know, as I said, I do a radio show called Snow Isles, and on that show we actually learn the Halkomelem language on the air. So my co-host, Laura Lewaluk, will say something in the language, and I get to repeat what she says right after her. And when I do that, you know what? It makes me feel things I've never felt before. It makes me really, really, really super, super happy. I almost feel like a different person, like I'm connecting to the ancestors. And it's just an amazing feeling. Amazing. You should try it one day. You have to get somebody to teach you a phrase in your language, and then you will just, like, be amazed at what comes out of that language for you personally in that moment. The one thing I realized that we need fluency in order to learn or relearn that language, we need to hear it fluently. We need to speak it fluently. And there's no time or space for that on the airwaves at this time. I think there's only one station, and it's called the New Hulk Station in British Columbia. And it's on the island there, and they have 8 hours of fluent speakers who talk the language. And I think that's what it's going to take. And I just don't know how to get from the point we are to that point. But they're doing it, and that's important. We just need more of it.
So as I had mentioned to you before, we've just recently started this Indigenous collective at CITR, which hasn't existed before, and we're now producing CITR's first Indigenous radio show, Unceded Airwaves. And so I'm wondering if you have any advice for our collective, which is made up of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
Well, let's see. I would say it would be good to hear current affairs within the context of language and culture. I think that's really helpful, to find ways to make our language and culture popular, whether it be through music, and make sure that you keep your doors wide and open for those who are interested in working at radio stations.
Okay, thank you so much. That's helpful. So I just want to thank you for coming onto the show today and taking your time out of your very busy schedule to spend some time with Eleanor and I, and also just for the work that you do. And I remember one of the first times that I was ever live on the radio was with you on Co-op, and I think that I felt reminiscent of how you did when you first started getting involved in radio. I was shy and it was nerve-wracking, but you threw me in there and you made me really comfortable, and I'm so grateful for that.
It's been my pleasure in any time.
Okay, thank you, Gunarji.
Okay, Gayla Kessler.
Hello, and thank you again for tuning in. This is CITR Radio 101.9. You're just listening to an interview with Gunarji O'Sullivan. I wanted to thank her again for coming in and sharing her stories. She's so incredibly generous with her time, and she has so much energy. I really appreciated when she talked about her mom and asked what would have been different for her if she had had radio as an outlet. It makes me feel that much more invested in this medium and that much more accountable. And so now I'm sitting with Sam Nock, who's returning from our first episode of Unceded Airwaves, and she's going to chat with us about some current events.
Hi. So Tansi, Samantha Nock, Nia Nitsi Kesan, Dawson Creek, Otsi Nia, Nia Mitchifisquayo, Kina Nasko Mintanawa Musqueam. So hello, I'm Samantha Nock, I'm Métis from Northern BC. And yeah, I'm here to talk to you about some cool events that are happening in the community. So first up, we have the Burnaby Mountain Anniversary Gathering. So it is hosted by the Tsleil Waututh Sacred Trust and Allies. And it's a day of learning and celebration to mark the one-year anniversary of the Burnaby Mountain Mobilization. So it's happening Sunday, November 22nd, 12 to 8 p.m., which is quite the time span, at the Vancouver Aboriginal Friendship Center. That is at 1607 East Hastings. Next up, we have the Squamish Nation Powwow.
Represent. Shouts out Celia.
Which is happening November 21st to the 22nd. Grand entry is at noon, and it's at the Totem Hall in Squamish, BC. And then we have Dance in Vancouver Studio showing the Dancers of Damlahamid.
Damlahamid?
Damlahamid?
Muhammad.
I owe so many people $20 because I can't say anything. they are going to be showing excerpts of their new dance work, and that is Wednesday, November 18th at 4 p.m. at the Dance Center at 677 Davie Street. And then on Friday, November 21st, we have Morning Coo's album release. So Morning Coo is the music genius of Chandra Melting Tallow, who is Blackfoot, and that's happening Friday, November 21st, doors at 7 at Horses Records on Hastings and Nanaimo. I forget the address. I'm sorry. I owe you $20. So it's at 7 p.m. It's pay what you can, $5 suggested donation, and all proceeds go to the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. All right. So we're just going to start talking to you about some interesting news stories that are happening right now.
Some current events.
Some current events with our homeboy, our favorite topic, Justin Trudeau.
Junior.
J-True. So if you have seen in the news, Justin Trudeau has called for a moratorium on crude oil tankers on the BC North Coast, which is interesting. A lot of environmentalist groups are saying that this is basically going to kill the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which is kind of an interesting topic to discuss. Because killing the pipeline kind of brings into conversation, I think it was something about 26 out of 46 First Nations that were consulted agreed to the pipeline. So killing the pipeline kind of brings in this interesting conversation about Indigenous sovereignty. So what about the, I think they're called Equitable Aboriginal Partners?
Right. And so someone had brought up to me, you know, Enbridge is like, well, what about consultation? I hope you've consulted First Nations people. And people are like, yeah, yeah, Enbridge, we know you don't give a, like, we know you don't give a crab apple about consultation. But I remember stepping back and thinking, well, you know what, like, there, you do have a point, because even though I am not pro extractive resources, I can't speak for other nations who might have a different economic standing than my nation does, and might have a different reliance on it than I do. And I still believe in divesting, but if I believe in consultation, I can't just believe that. I will only think that that's important when it's convenient to me and my values, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It's really this double-edged sword where we call for consultation in our communities. But, I mean, we're nations of very diverse people that come from different backgrounds that have different opinions. And so, you know, people need jobs, and resource extraction brings in money to communities. And so, you know, we have these consultation processes, and then we have our nations that agree to them, which we know harm the environment, which we know are very harmful. But then, you know, it boosts our economy and it puts food on people's tables.
Yeah, it's like the immediate versus the long term, mm-hmm. right? Like long term, we have people that understand the importance of divesting in these industries because of how important our land and resources are. And then the other discussion is, well, what does consultation look like if you're consulting a band council? Mm-hmm. And what does consultation really mean if your band council is approving something and your nation's not?
Yeah.
Right. So there's all these layers about what it means to put this moratorium on. Again, though, you are speaking for people and taking away the right to the duty to consult.
Yeah. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I may ruffle some feather. But I feel like whenever an Indigenous nation kind of disagrees with environmentalists or says, like, you know what, we're okay with this because it's going to put food on our tables and money in the bank, a lot of environmentalist groups are really quick to, like, jump on Indigenous nations, and even other Indigenous nations are like, oh, you're sellouts.
How dare you?
Yeah.
And it's just like,
it's complex.
It's
right?
So complex.
And it's a hard conversation to have, because obviously I don't want Enbridge to go through.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of Indigenous people and nations that have been very clear that they don't want that either.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder what the process of consultation could look like, where this moratorium could be implemented, but Indigenous people could be called to the table to talk about what this means. And if you're going to, if like you're saying, there's these numbers of nations that have talked about wanting to bring this into their territory, or their councils have talked about bringing it into their territories, then if you're going to put on this moratorium, what else can you offer to help sustain nations whose resources are being exploited without their consent, right?
Yeah. Well, then you just, like, have Junior, Justin Trudeau, coming in and doing this thing, which, you know, sounds really awesome. He's putting a moratorium on tankers on the coast. Everybody's like, yeah, that's awesome. Protect the waters, obviously, which we want. But then he's like, you know what I kind of like, though? I kind of like that Keystone Pipeline that Obama was like, hell no, that's not happening. And Junior's like, but why?
I know.
And so you just have this really double-edged sword. We're just like,
make up your mind, Junior.
Make up your mind, Junior. Like, I know.
Let's just dance on oil, Junior.
Junior. Like, we know what? You have to run your motorcycle that you drive around on. Your hide a tattoo blaring. But
something's got to make that. Something's got to make him fly.
Something's got to give, Junior. Something's got to give.
Yeah.
So it's this really complex and difficult subject we have that actually really tears apart community sometimes. Like, it's really difficult conversations mm-hmm. to have.
And then again, with my own community, we're in the process of grappling with what's going to happen in Howe Sound with wood fiber LNG. So that's this whole messy situation, and stuff's going to get heated.
Heaty.
Yeah. Stuff's going to get a little intense in Vancouver as this starts to unfold, and there's a lot of nation members that don't want this anywhere near our sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
It's just this conversation of what does consultation look like?
Yeah, and who gets consulted, who doesn't.
And what does Indigenous sovereignty look like in this stance as well?
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, our band councils and our governing bodies are being consulted, but our actual people aren't. And so is that Indigenous sovereignty? Is that actual full consultation with people? Or is that just the powers to be playing with other powers to be, you know?
Yeah.
And what's going to happen is the way that indigenous sovereignty is going to look like in Squamish if this goes through is just direct action. That's what it comes down to constantly, right? It's the only guarantee that this might not be erected in our house sound.
Oh, no. There's, like, people, like, clutching their collars and, like, ooh, it's hot in here. Mm-hmm. Are those natives on the air saying direct action?
Sovereignty? What?
Sovereignty?
Okay, what is next on our news agenda, Sam?
So in Cape Breton, there has been a call for a moose call. That's a tongue twister. Say that 10 times fast.
Call for moose call.
Not actually, Celia.
Oh, I was like, I can do it.
I know you can. Later. So there's been a call for a moose call by Parks Canada, who are saying, like, damn, there's a lot of moose here, and they're eating all the shrubbery we really like.
Where's Cape Breton?
Nova Scotia.
No, oh.
Is it?
I don't know.
Oh, my God.
That's why I asked.
This is embarrassing.
Somewhere.
Somewhere out east on an island. Don't Google it. So Parks Canada called for a moose call on Cape Breton that only Mi'kmaq people could call the moose. And for those who are like, what does culling mean? Culling is killing. Basically, like, a mass killing of moose on Cape Breton to save these important fauna that Parks Canada is like, we like them, we need them. And the Mi'kmaq are like, yeah, we know what we like them and we need them, and we also like eating moose.
Mm.
And then all these non-Mi'kmaq white hunters were like, that's really unfair. I want to kill the moose too. And then there's this big protest that basically canceled the moose call. It's happening now, but there's this big protest where it got really heated between white hunters and Mi'kmaq folks about the moose call. And so this brings up really interesting conversations about treaty rights and Parks Canada and people hunting.
So this is happening right now, these protests?
Right now. It happened the day of the call, though. These non-Mi'kmaq hunters were standing there like, hell no, you can't kill these moose. And apparently one had a sign that said, what was it? It was like, Parks Canada's prejudice against white hunters. And I'm just like,
oh my God,
what are you really protesting here?
Right.
Like, are you protesting, like, you want to hunt moose because there is a hunting season you can do that in? Or are you protesting that your feelings are hurt because people are being able to execute their treaty rights?
Right.
Right? Which is, like, ruffles a lot of like, I know where we are right now isn't a treaty. This part of BC isn't covered by a treaty. Where I'm from, in Treaty 8, there are a lot of really intense conversations that happen between treaty members and, like, white hunters, basically, about who gets to kill what, where, and when.
Hmm.
And so if you're not treaty, you need to have a hunting license, and there's only specific months you can hunt during, and there's only specific animals you can take.
Right.
Which, when you are a treaty, you have a different negotiation with the government and when you can hunt and what you can hunt and when you can do it. So, you know, this conversation isn't just about Parks Canada being prejudiced against white hunters.
Right. It's a bigger discussion.
It's a bigger discussion about people not understanding treaty rights. And one of the hunters that was interviewed was like, well, you know, I don't really understand treaty rights, but this is unfair.
And I'm like, classic.
Classic.
Did they have a plan with what they were going to do with the moose, or who was going to get to hunt them, or what was going to happen to the...
It was Mi'kmaq hunters that were going to be allowed to hunt them and use the moose. So eat it, use the moose for
this
other...
This is a negotiation that came about afterwards, and then
this is prior with Parks Canada and the Mi'kmaq.
Okay.
Parks Canada was like, damn, I got a lot of moose. And the Mi'kmaq are like, we know what to do with moose. We've been doing this for a hell of a long time. And Parks Canada was like, you're right, Mi'kmaq. And, you know, having, like, a major government body being like, we trust these natives in the corner here to do what's right is like, what?
They're like, all right.
All right. And the Mi'kmaq are like, hell yeah, moose.
Okay, so that's where the conflict has come from.
Yeah.
That you have these white hunters being like, well, what about my moose?
Not all hunters. Celia just dropped her phone.
Phone drop.
Yeah, so that was the conversation, which is kind of ties into what we're talking about consultation earlier with the... tankers in the coast, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean for indigenous sovereignty? What does this mean for treaty rights?
Yeah, and it wasn't a collaboration with Mi'kmaq being like, how would we like, how can we collaboratively work to think about the environment here?
No, it was. It was Parks Canada and Mi'kmaq working together. And then it was the white hunters that were left out.
Okay. So from the beginning? Because it kind of sounds like Parks Canada was going to be like, this is what I'm going to do. And Mi'kmaq was like, oh, also, could you think about us? Because we'll do this if you want.
No, it was like, Parks Canada was like, this is what they're going to do. And the Mi'kmaq were like, cool. And then right. they work together to be like,
oh, okay.
you right. know what? We just need to actually just like nix these moves.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You're painting a picture now.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm sorry. I mean, the audience gets it. I'm just
Do
slow.
You? Do you?
I get it now.
Thank you.
And I'm hungry for moose.
Me too.
That's the real takeaway from this is that I want some moose jerky.
Actually, if anybody has any moose out there, hit me up.
If you liked this episode, you can pay us in moose.
Actually.
Okay, well.
Will barter for moose.
Will barter for, will radio banter for moose.
Actually.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for tuning in again to Unceded Airwaves. This is our second episode. Thank you so much, Sam, for coming and being on the show again. Thank you for your witty banter and your endless Trudeau jokes. Please tune in again next week at 11. And up next is Synchronicity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mark your calendars. Discorder Magazine's